This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we talk about mass arrests going back to the Trump inauguration in D.C. and the charges people are facing.
This is a sea change. The Trump administration has announced they will monitor people's ideas and activities and charge them sometimes with crimes that'll put them in prison for life just for participating in a demonstration.
On the 100th anniversary of the Russian Revolution, we welcome author Paul LeBlanc to talk about his new book.
It's called October Song. I'm reminded of the first line of the great revolutionary song, The Internationale, which goes, "Arise, ye prisoners of starvation, arise, ye wretched of the earth." And that's exactly what happened in Russia 100 years ago. And we're going to talk about that and its lessons for today.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian. Last January, at Donald Trump's inauguration, over 230 people, some protesters, some not, were trapped and arrested by police. Federal prosecutors charged them with a crime that actually doesn't exist in D.C. It's called felony rioting. Armed with secret warrants, prosecutors then proceeded to probe deeply into the defendants' personal lives. Charges were dropped for some arrestees, including journalists and legal observers. More than 200, however, actually saw their charges increased to felony rioting, felony incitement to riot, conspiracy to riot, and property damage crimes related to broken windows. Each defendant faces over 60 years in prison. The warrants that prosecutors obtained sought a list of visitors to a protest-related website and the Facebook friends and related communications of two organizers, the host of a coalition Facebook page and those who had liked that page. This prosecution follows a change in local law enforcement's response to protest that we covered years ago on Law and Disorder. The mass arrests and harsh charges are precisely what new D.C. policies were designed to avoid. A 2002 mass arrest and subsequent lawsuit by the Partnership for Civil Justice resulted in the district paying over $10 million in settlements and changing its crowd control policies. Trials for the inauguration protesters begin in mid-November 2017 and are expected to continue for about a year. Joining us to discuss these unprecedented charges is Guild member Yale Bromberg. Yale is a supervising attorney and teaching fellow with the Institute for Public Representation at the Civil Rights Clinic of Georgetown University Law Center. Yale, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me.
Michael and I missed this year's inauguration in D.C. Tell us what transpired leading up to these mass arrests.
So here's the rundown. January 20th was the day of President Trump's inauguration. Early in the morning, activists blockaded checkpoints to the Inauguration Day celebration, and they shut down entrances to attendees. But elsewhere, activists gathered in downtown D.C. around 10 a.m., and that gathering evolved into a march through the heart of D.C.'s lobbyist sector. There was some minor property destruction, such as a few broken windows and a trash can or two that was knocked over, but the police set up a barricade in front of the march just before 11 a.m., an hour later, and then they closed the trap, thereby kettling over 230 people indiscriminately in response to the actions of a few unidentified people. So in other words, police seized all of these people without individualized probable cause, because of acts of property destruction nearby. And once in the kettle, the arrest happens really slowly. The last person was hauled away by police 8 hours later. Those that were kettled, they were subjected to chemical weapons spray just feet away. They were eventually subjected to full cavity searches once arrested. And while they were in the kettle, they were refused access to bathroom and food. Oh, and your listeners and others who've been paying attention to the story, they may have seen pictures of a limousine being set on fire. But that happened at 4:15, several hours after the kettle began and after the police rioted against people who were standing outside the kettle in the early afternoon.
Okay,
the
wait. Problem, sorry. Yeah. Hold on a sec. You've said a lot of things that Michael and I are staring at each other. No, no. We have a few clarifying questions.
Okay.
When you say kettle, here in New York, we often see police bringing out orange netting that they surround people with. Is that what they do in D.C.?
If I recall, there was some type of line that was set up. But, you know, essentially what it looked like is the police stuffed detainees indiscriminately into a street corner and lined up around them and did not allow people to enter or leave that barrier that the police formed.
Got it. When you talk about the police, this is a national special security event. We should clarify what that means. It means that Secret Service and various levels of law enforcement, in addition to the D.C. police, are in attendance, correct?
That's right. There were a range of police officers wearing different types of uniforms and insignia throughout downtown D.C., including at this specific incident that we're discussing.
Okay. And then Michael and I were talking before you came on. When you mentioned this limousine on fire, you know, we can speculate about this, but in the past at some of these national special security events, we've read and learned about through litigation the use of agents provocateur, which has been used to impugn protesters who were later found to be innocent. Do you think that factors into this whole guilt by association and violating the law about not engaging in mass arrests?
It may. You know, we know of previous episodes where that's taken place. I don't know who set the limousine on fire. I don't know if the police know it. You know, I don't know the specifics of that. But the problem with the media coverage and just the kind of the public statements is that they implicate all of the arrestees, over 200 people, for the limousine fire, even though those arrestees were already seized, confined, and arrested when that happened. And the other thing that the resulting media coverage failed to acknowledge is the role that the police played in the general escalation. And I'm happy to talk about that later. And it was also covered by the D.C. Police Board.
Yeah, we'll certainly talk about that, Yael. You said that there were, quote, few unidentified people knocked over trash cans and that broke a couple of windows. Mm-hmm. That's, I think, what's so dangerous, because demonstrations that I've been on, starting in the 60s with the civil rights demonstrations, which then became the anti-war demonstrations, were massive, and they were massive because we got out the word that these were going to be nonviolent demonstrations. Bring your family and the kids. We're going to have monitors to make sure that they're kept that way. And that's what the National Lawyers Guild does as observers to make sure that there are no lone wolves out there doing something dangerous. And the reason it's dangerous is that conspiracy laws, which are being used against these 200-some people in D.C., are really laws that put out a thought crime. The conspiracy prosecution is the darling of the prosecutors because they don't have to approve an underlying crime. All they've got to prove is that this was in the mind of somebody who wanted to do this and conspired with other people to do this. So it's very hard for lawyers to defend against a conspiracy charge. And that makes it very inviting, I think, for what Heidi mentioned, that the government send in agents to provoke violence and then blame everybody for it. We're afraid that this is what might be going down in D.C. now.
We know that's speculation, but it is troubling to us, and that's why the regulations were changed in D.C. And we're going to talk about the report a little bit that the Office of Police, the review board in D.C. issued, saying this was improper. But we want to clarify something. Federal prosecutors brought these charges. Did they essentially elbow out the local police?
It's hard to know exactly what happened. My understanding is that if there's a felony involved, because D.C. is not a state, which is its own set of problems, that the U.S. Attorney's Office prosecutes felonies.
Got it.
Because after the people that Mara Verhaelghian Hilliard and others organized, they had a different set of practices in D.C. And
right.
It seems to me now that the Trump administration and Jefferson Beauregard Sessions are changing the rules and making it very difficult and dangerous for people to come to D.C. and demonstrate.
I think that's right, and it's a major concern because obviously not Washington, D.C. is the nation's capital, so there's going to be a range of issues that protesters would want to come and exercise their First Amendment rights on. And also, Washington, D.C. kind of establishes a bookmark for the rest of the country. If something can pass in Washington, D.C., it could pass elsewhere. So we are very concerned. The Trump administration seems to be trampling on the laws that, as you said, Mara and her organization established regarding First Amendment rights to freedom of speech and assembly in the city.
What happened the next day procedurally?
Yes, so the next day, the prosecutors charged them with felony rioting, over 200 people again, and that's a non-existent crime in D.C. And then there was a superseding indictment that was later returned in April, which included a range of felony charges against all of the defendants, and that included felony incitement, felony engagement, and felony conspiracy to engage in a riot, and a handful of felony charges associated with destruction of property. And corresponding to that, the prosecution launched a sweeping investigation into the lives of the arrestees and even into the lives of their friends and associates.
You and fellow Guild member Eric Chevreud wrote really a tremendous article on Common Dreams, and you put the riot charges in context quite effectively. You mentioned, for example, that in 2006, Steelers fans rioted after their team won the Super Bowl and caused over $150,000 in damage, yet no rioting charges were brought. How does that differ from this case?
That's right. So thanks for the article was co-authored with Eric, and he's just brilliant. It was published by Common Dreams and more recently by The Guardian.
Congratulations.
So, thank you. I think it's the number one trending piece right now in The Guardian, actually, which is exciting.
Well done.
How do you get it on the internet? What do you type in to get the article?
I think it's just probably our names. It was published today, so I just saw it.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
And riot, D.C. riot, I guess.
Okay, so getting back to your question, it's simple. In one case, protesters are exercising their First Amendment rights in a way that condemns the state. And when the protesters are engaged in an act of dissent, their conduct becomes labeled as rioting and deserving of a lifetime in prison. But as you said, in the case of the Steelers fans, you know, that's a sporting event. And in that case, they even caused up to $150,000 in property damages. But there, it's just considered people letting off steam. And in the case of the Steelers' victory, rioters overturned cars, uprooted street signs, and burnt a business awning. And while there were some individualized charges associated with those riots, there was no riot charge involved, and there was no guilt by association charges assumed to the group, and no conspiracy. It's not just the examples we cited in the article. So, for example, San Francisco after the Giants won in 2014, Ohio State in 2015, New Hampshire in 2014 over pumpkins of all things, 2011 at Penn State, there were no riot charges, and not so coincidentally, there's no critique of the state underlying the unrest.
Let's go back to the D.C. case and the original subpoena requests for information, because we've talked about how prosecutors looked into sort of the personal lives of a lot of these people. How broad were these subpoena requests, and did they mention what they were trying to find out?
Sure. So the subpoena was extraordinarily broad. In fact, observers feared that the government's aim was simply to create a McCarthy-style list of dissidents for their own record-keeping purposes. The original subpoena implicated even third parties who may not even have been in Washington, D.C. For example, it included someone who would have simply liked the coalition's Facebook page. As a result, their association would be threatened along with the release of their identity. If someone simply visited the coalition's website, they would similarly be implicated.
So who was subpoenaed? The people that were arrested? They were required to give information, and then it brought it out to branches of a tree?
Well, the subpoena was issued upon the website's host. So it was called DreamHost was the website platform. Uh-huh. And so they were requesting the web addresses of visitors. And they were also requesting, in that subpoena, they were requesting the names of individuals, for example, who had signed up to be on the listserv associated with the coalition. So, for example, when there was an invitation to join a meeting or just general information that would publish the calendar of events for the inauguration day that was hosted by the coalition, if somebody had plugged in their email address through the web portal, that would have been caught up within the subpoena itself. And as you know, many people's email addresses are self-identified. It's just their first and last name at whatever.com. So their identity would immediately be disclosed. And in the case of the other subpoena, that was actually a subpoena on Facebook for individuals that simply liked the coalition's Facebook, or for individuals that had exchanged some type of Facebook messages with some of the organization hosts, or had liked something that one of the hosts had posted on their page. And so it was extraordinarily broad and reached beyond just, you know, the specifics of what happened on Inauguration Day.
So if I check out something on the internet about a demonstration in D.C. and I like it and I ask for further information and I give them my email address, the federal government can then come and interview me, find out whether I went on the demonstration, and later charge me with a conspiracy to do criminal stuff just by my clicking on my iPhone. Is that a danger?
Right. That's a huge danger, and that's ostensibly what the U.S. Attorney's Office was attempting to collect through this online dragnet. And, you know, that's why observers really feared that this was just kind of a McCarthyist attempt to collect a list of dissidents, because it is so broad. So really, they would have just collected, and because of the nature of this particular activity, protesting the inauguration of President Trump, there was a fear that, there was kind of a justifiable fear, that they were simply looking for citizens or non-citizens that were simply anti-Trump.
Okay. Did Facebook and DreamHost turn over this information? That, to me, is troubling that they didn't fight it.
There were some fights associated with it, which is why, at the end of the day, the court decided to enforce the warrants but limited their scope. So there was a back and forth, and DreamHost also was, you know, rightfully pushed and rightfully, agreed to issue notices to people who would have been kind of caught in between this. So a range of people received notices, people that kind of stepped forward and said, hey, what is this about, right? Because they certainly were not participating in violence. Some of them didn't even come to that day's activities, right? They just wanted to be in the loop in case they wanted to attend a workshop or another type of program that was taking place throughout the city and that was being advertised through these portals. So there was pushback with regard to turning over the information, and as a result, the court issued a decision that at least limited their scope somewhat.
All right. Well, that's somewhat heartening.
Right.
If you don't mind, let's go back briefly to the actual mass arrests. The D.C. Office of Police Complaints wrote a report about these arrests. In a nutshell, what did that report say?
The report was based on firsthand observations by staff monitors that were dispersed throughout downtown D.C. by the D.C. Office of Police Complaints. It focused on two central concerns. First, The board found that the arrests may not have been carried out according to standard operating procedures and speculated as to the lack of individualized probable cause and the requirement of providing multiple audible warnings, including a clear dispersal route and sufficient time to disperse. And second, the board found it concerning that that less than lethal weapons were used indiscriminately and without adequate warnings in certain circumstances. That's a direct quote from the board's report. The board confirmed that MPD indiscriminately deployed stingers. And for reference for your listeners, stingers have a combined deployment of pepper spray, tear gas, rubber bullets, and a flashbang. It's very startling for people that are in the area of it. And the board also confirmed instances where MPD officers threw stingers into the air, into the crowd, which is a possible violation of MPD training guidelines as well.
What good is this report going to do?
Well, the report has caused people to pay attention in D.C., including certain members on the D.C. Council. And in addition, there was a line item in this year's budget, if I remember correctly, dedicated towards further investigations of what took place. Also, as a result of the use of weaponry, various FOIA requests have been submitted, including by the National Lawyers Guild. The report really goes to further validate what NLG legal observers saw took place, and you know, anyone who was in the area really saw, which was what was perceived as police escalation and this indiscriminate mass arrest.
This really underlies, I think, the problem of selective prosecution. And I wanted to ask you about the government's response to the pre-planned armed violence and rioting by white supremacists and private militia groups in Charlottesville, Virginia. You know, nothing like what's going down against the anti-Trump demonstrators in D.C. happened to these Nazis and white supremacists in Charlottesville, did they?
No, absolutely. And I think that this is such a great counterpoint to highlight, because Charlottesville involved a riot. And it involves a pre-planned armed violence, as you said, by white supremacists and private militia groups. Also, the Unite the Right rally involved substantial online communications to organize the day's activities through online chat rooms. And so there was no sweeping online dragnet that we've seen so far to identify organizers of the Charlottesville riot. And those are organizers who conspired to plan, promote, and carry out the violence. There's a point that I want to make sure to put a pin in, specifically with the comparison with Charlottesville, is that Charlottesville involved violence against people, and it even resulted in a murder, the beating of activists standing up to a message of genocide, and dozens of injuries from a car attack. That was violence against people and not violence against property, yet the federal prosecutors have done little to nothing. Online activists have exposed and identified a few white supremacists, which caused local law enforcement to issue some charges, largely due to public pressure. But in Charlottesville, there's been no felony riot charges, no charges of guilt by association, no police raids, and no sweeping investigation.
That's because the government tipped its hand and said there was violence on both sides, you know, and they didn't do anything about it. We know where this government is leaning.
How can our listeners learn more about these cases, which we understand may take a year or so to wind through the courts?
Sure. Well, the first trial started mid-November for just a handful of the arrestees and will continue, as you said, for several months. To learn more, listeners can go to www.defendj20resistance.org. And they can also click on the support tab of that website, defendj20resistance.org, to donate to the Legal Defense Funds.
Yael, you became a lawyer and got involved in this kind of democratic rights work. Heidi and I would like to know personally how you got interested in doing this kind of stuff.
Sure. I focus on constitutional litigation, but I guess it's no surprise that I ended up kind of doing this work also in support with the local guild chapter. Arthur Kinoy played a major leadership role in the guild, including as president for several years. I had previously worked at two other institutions that he co-founded. I was a Kinois Davis Fellow at the Rutgers School of Law's Constitutional Litigation Clinic, and also an Ella Baker Fellow with the Center for Constitutional Rights. But specifically, I got involved in this First Amendment area in connection with my work with Law for Black Lives DC, which is a grassroots legal support arm for the Black Lives Matter movement. And I went up to Baltimore during the Freddie Gray uprising to do legal observation and jail support, and have since kind of continued those efforts supporting First Amendment activities in Washington, D.C.
Well, I think Arthur would be extremely proud of you. We really hope that we can stay in touch to hear how these cases are proceeding. And I think I speak for all of us when I say thank you so much.
Yeah, and good luck.
Thank you. Thank you for having us. It's been a real pleasure to be able to share this with you all and with your listeners as well.
And we'll look for your article in The Guardian.
We appreciate it so much, your being a guest on Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Going to interview the historian Paul LeBlanc on his brand new book, October Song. And at the beginning of the book is a poem called October Song, written by a friend of mine, Dan Georgiakis. And I wondered whether you'd share that short poem with our audience.
I'd love to, Michael. They who never ruled before poured from their factory districts across the bridges of Petrograd to make October. The moon was so startled, all global tides shifted. The lights went on all over Europe. Nothing can ever be the same.
This year marks the 100th anniversary of the Russian Revolution of October 1917. The revolution changed the course of history and determined world politics internationally and in the United States of America for most of the 20th century, until finally, under the unrelenting onslaught of the West and principally the USA, the revolution was overthrown in 1991 when capitalism was restored to that country. Before the revolution, Russia was a feudal monarchy headed up by a czar in a country where most of the population were peasants working the land under near slave-like conditions. World War I started in 1914 and found Russia allied with France and Great Britain against Germany and other countries. It was a war for foreign markets, resources, and colonies. 3 years later, by 1917, 30 million people had been killed. 1 week alone, 250,000 soldiers were killed. The Russian Revolution was nearly bloodless and nonviolent. The first thing the revolutionary government did was to end their country's participation in the war, which ultimately ended the war. The second thing they did was to redistribute the land to the peasants who worked it. Then they nationalized industry under control of the workers in the plants. Thus, the 1% of the Russian elite were dispossessed, and the 99% took control over the institutions of their country and ran them through councils of workers and peasants and soldiers. The councils had been organized prior to the revolution. They were led by socialists. The Russian Revolution inspired the hopes of humankind throughout the industrial and underdeveloped world. The peasants were given land, women gained equal rights and the right to get an abortion and to vote. Homosexuality was made legal. Minority rights were guaranteed. Education, the arts, and culture received governmental support. For a period of time, Russia was the most democratic country on the planet. We speak today with history professor Paul LeBlanc about the Russian Revolution and the lessons it teaches us for social change activists in America today. Paul LeBlanc is the author of the just-published book, October Song, Bolshevik Triumph, Communist Tragedy, 1917 through 1924. He is the author of a number of widely read studies, including Lenin and the Revolutionary Party, and has been an activist in the civil rights and anti-war movement over the many years. He teaches at La Roche College in Pittsburgh.
Paul LeBlanc, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be here.
Henry Ford famously said that history is bunk. And we know that you don't think so, given that you're an historian. Today we want to talk about what we can learn from the history of the Russian Revolution that would be useful today in America. The subtitle of your new book, October Song, is Bolshevik Triumph, Communist Tragedy, 1917 to 1924. What was the nature of the Bolshevik triumph? And first of all, who were they?
Well, the Bolsheviks were a radical left wing of the Russian socialist movement. And in Russia, you had a very repressive regime under the Tsar. He was like an absolute monarch. And combined with that oppressive political system, there was a social and economic system dominated by rich landowners and then also factory owners, capitalists, businessmen. And the majority of the people were poor, downtrodden, exploited by those on top. For years, there had been a revolutionary movement in Russia to struggle for freedom and democracy, including economic democracy, which is what socialists consider socialism to be. They wanted political democracy and economic democracy. A majority of the people in Russia were peasants, but there was a growing working class, particularly in the cities, factory workers and other wage workers and salary workers, who many of whom were drawn to the socialist movement. There were several socialist organizations, but one was called the Russian Social Democratic Labor Party, and it gained more and more and more members, and the Bolsheviks were the revolutionary left wing of that party. And there were plenty of grievances existing in Russia throughout the 19th and early 20th century. And so the revolutionary movement was able to grow, you know, because of that. In some cases, workers fought for short-term gains and were able to win those gains, and that made them more self-confident and helped the socialist movement grow more. And then the First World War had a devastating impact on the people of Russia, and that made things even worse and generated the Russian Revolution. And the Bolsheviks were the most uncompromising current in the revolutionary movement who helped to lead to the revolutionary victory of 1917.
Paul, the Russian Revolution, contrary to what most people have been led to believe, was relatively nonviolent. How were the socialists able to arrange a relatively peaceful transfer of power? Please explain the role of the Soviets.
All right, and that last question is extremely important. And the Soviet is a Russian word, and it means council. And actually, in 1917, there were two revolutions, one in March or February. The Russians at that time went according to the Julian calendar, which was February when the revolution took place. But for us, it was March, and actually on International Women's Day, the revolution began. And it began with women workers who were protesting the high price of bread and the inability of many to buy bread. They were also calling for liberty and freedom and an end to the war. And the protests snowballed. They were joined by male workers and others. And by that time, in March of 1917, or February 1917, there was such anger against the war and against the oppressive conditions and the general disillusionment with the status quo and the existing power structure that masses of people came into motion and were predominantly in the cities, but there was also a lot of support from the countryside. The peasants were demanding land. Most of the land was monopolized by the rich landowners. And when soldiers were brought out by the czarist officials to shoot down the workers, to shoot down the protesters, these soldiers were sick of the war. They were workers and peasants, mostly peasants in uniform. And they sympathized with the protesters, and they went over to the side of the protesters. Very, very quickly then, with some violence, but a minimal amount of violence, the whole czarist order collapsed. The Soviets were the councils that the workers and soldiers and peasants were forming to coordinate their activity and then to help keep their communities and workplaces running, in the midst of this revolutionary upheaval. And they maintained a significant amount of power, and they were demanding, we want peace, an end to the war, we want bread, we want land for the peasants, we want freedom and liberty. And this had majority support throughout Russia. Now, then there was a second revolution in October or November, depending on which calendar you're using, but it's popularly known as the October Revolution. And that was, in some ways, even more peaceful than the first. The situation had developed where, on the one hand, you had these councils that existed and had grown strong throughout much of Russia. But then some of the old-time politicians, various liberals and conservatives, even some moderate socialists, put together a provisional government. And initially there was cooperation between the Soviets and the provisional government, and the provisional government said, yes, we want to give you all these things, but we've got to have peace with honor, so we've got to stay involved in the war. And we don't want to move too fast on land reform because big landowners should have rights too, and we'll get around to supplying bread, when things, get better and so on. So there was a growing amount among the population of dissatisfaction and anger that what they had fought for in the earlier overthrow of the Tsar was still not being realized. The Bolsheviks, the most revolutionary currents in the movement, agitated for down with the provisional government, let's give all power to the Soviets, let's get peace, bread, land, and move forward to socialism. By September, October, November, given experiences that people were going through, that won majority support, and there was very little violence in the transition to the creation of, all power to the Soviets in the October Revolution.
Paul, why do you believe that Russia, after revolution, was the most democratic society the world had ever seen before or since?
I would be cautious as an historian to say it was the most democratic, but it was definitely very democratic, for sure. And at least initially, it was extremely democratic because this was a popular revolution that had put all power into the hands of these democratic councils of the people of Russia, peasants, soldiers, sailors, workers, people who had made the revolution and supported the revolution, and they were able to speak their minds, they were able to disagree with each other, they were able to consider different points of view in these councils in the Soviets, and there was like a network of Soviets and, in the various localities that would then elect representatives or delegates to a higher Soviet, a citywide Soviet and regional and then national Soviet. So it was very democratic in that way. And then also if people who had elected a delegate to the higher Soviets, if they didn't like what that person was doing, they could recall that person and replace them with somebody who they who would carry out what they were calling for. So, especially in the early period, there was a tremendously enthusiastic and democratic atmosphere that was structured in this extremely democratic way. Because of the situation that developed quickly after that, there were increasing restrictions. There was a civil war that was initiated. There were foreign invasions. There was a collapse of the economy. But before those terrible calamities had an impact on the political life of the early Soviet Republic, it was incredible, as you say, it was incredibly democratic.
We're speaking with Paul LeBlanc, who had his wonderful book, October Song, just published. Paul, what gains did people in Russia make with respect to, say, women's rights?
Well, women's rights and all kinds of other rights, tremendous, amazing gains were made. I mean, women had been at best second-class citizens in this patriarchal culture that existed in old Russia, but there was patriarchal culture all around the world. Women in the United States at that time did not have the right to vote, in many other countries as well. Women got the right to vote in Russia. Women had equal rights in Russia. Women had rights in terms of the marriage situation. They could decide if they had they were in an abusive situation, they could end the marriage, or for any other reason, if they felt that they weren't getting along with their spouse, they could end that marriage. And that was new. And that was new not just in Russia, but around the world. Considering women as full, equal citizens, you know, was a very radical concept at that time. And it was implemented right away in Russia. And not just women. It's interesting in terms of gay rights. Homosexual, lesbian relationships, which had been considered criminal activity, immoral criminal activity, not just in Russia but around the world, that was decriminalized. Russia had been, the Russian Empire had been considered the prison house of nations. There were many oppressed national groups and ethnic groups in Russia. And here, too, tremendous cultural rights and political rights were extended to the very suppressed national and ethnic minorities. To the working class as a whole, there were tremendous gains. The eight-hour workday was established right away, and workers had the right to now organize trade unions and organize in their workplaces to have control over their situation. Art, literature, literacy, culture was extended beyond the privileged elites to in Russia to masses of people who learned how to read, who were exposed to all kinds of, you know, wonderful creative activities and drawn into them. So there was a general flourishing of rights, gains for the average Russian, for the majority of the Russian people.
Paul, what was Lenin's vision of the future society that he wrote about in his book, State and Revolution?
Yeah, that's a very interesting book because it argues, and it's not just Lenin who thought this, this was a basic Marxist concept, and he helped to retrieve some of the thinking of Marx that had been forgotten by some revolutionaries. Marx argued that the state is essentially a repressive institution, that it upholds the perspectives and the interests of the ruling classes, the ruling powerful and wealthy ruling elites in various societies, and that if the people were able to take control of their own country through revolution, that the state would become increasingly democratic and would eventually evaporate, that democracy would become like a habit among the population. He didn't think this would happen right away, but that his goal, and as outlined in the book State and Revolution and in his speeches and initial policies, his goal was to create more and more rule by the people, more and more democracy. He believed that ordinary people should be able to run and would be able to run the government, run the economy, and so forth. And that's what he was pushing for, not only Lenin, but others who had that perspective among the Bolsheviks. That was their vision of what they were fighting for.
Lenin, of course, was the principal leader of the Russian Revolution. It would not have happened without Lenin. Trotsky was a co-leader, but the Russian Revolution most likely would have happened without him. But Lenin really was a central figure. How did the United States respond to the Russian Revolution, Paul?
Well, the United States responded in different ways, depending on who you're looking at. So, for example, one of the most exciting and one of the most informative accounts of the Russian Revolution was written by an eyewitness, a radical journalist named John Reed. He wrote a book called 10 Days That Shook the World. that people today, whether they're liberal or conservative or revolutionary or whatever, they say this is a valuable book. It was an eyewitness account. And Reed was very enthusiastic, as were other people, Eugene Victor Debs, who was a great working class leader, a trade unionist, a socialist, said in Russia, the day of the people has arrived. So there was, on the one hand, enthusiasm on the part of some people in the United States. On the other hand, the U.S. ambassador to the United States, who represented the business interests, he was a businessman himself from Missouri, David Francis, was also a representative of the liberal Democratic Party president, Woodrow Wilson. He hated the Russian Revolution. He was horrified that workers would have this kind of power, that women would have the right to divorce their husbands and so forth. He thought it was terrible and that the United States should try to crush this terrible threat to civilization. And that was his point of view. And it wasn't just his point of view. The U.S. government as a whole was very hostile to the Russian Revolution. And of course, the business leaders also were very hostile. They thought it was a terrible example that working people, the working class majority and the peasants and so forth, should take over their own economy, their own country, take it out of the hands of the private owners. They were against that. So there was a mixed reaction in the United States, but the U.S. government and other governments around the world, the British government, other governments, tried to destroy the revolution. They supported anti-revolutionary elements in Russia. They sent troops. They created an economic blockade in order to prevent the revolution from being successful.
Paul, I just wanted to mention, when you talked about the role of John Reed and his companion Louise Bryant, also wrote terrific articles about what was going on
yes.
there. And a movie was made about that called Reds. You know that
yes.
movie, Heidi, with Warren Beatty,
right.
Diane Keaton. It's a great movie. It's called Reds, and you can get it on Netflix, I think, so you should check it out. But, Heidi, you had a question.
Paul, let's talk about the other part of your book's subtitle, Communist Tragedy. What crisis overwhelmed the democratic libertarian dreams of the Bolsheviks that resulted in an authoritarian government?
Yeah, that's an extremely important question, and that's a major part of what I wanted to deal with in the book. There's been controversy, of course, about the Russian Revolution from the very, very beginning. For those of us who have an understanding of the extremely democratic and humanistic goals of the revolution, the question is sharply posed, how did something so good turn out so badly at the end? What was the cause of the failure? Why did, in the name of communism, why was a terrible dictatorship established associated with Joseph Stalin some years later? That terrible dictatorship killed many of the people who had helped to make the revolution. In the case of Trotsky, drove him out of the Soviet Union and then murdered him some years later, set up trials, put on trial various other people who had been revolutionary leaders, executed many, sent many to prison, all in the name of communism. How could such a thing have happened? And so I wrestle with that in the book. And in our discussion earlier, I said that the original, super democratic reality of the revolution was quickly overwhelmed by several things, and I want to go over some of those again. There were 14 different countries that sent troops to help destroy the Russian Revolution. Enormous quantities of military materiel and money and so forth were given to some people wanted to preserve capitalism in Russia. Some people wanted to bring back the czarist system. And there were many people in the confusion of the revolution who were drawn into counter-revolutionary activities, at least for a while. So there was extreme violence from those quarters, and there was also the extreme violence of the First World War that had devastated the Russian economy, and there was an economic blockade. And there was an emergency situation. Instead of realizing a society in which there would be more and more democracy, more and more freedom, there was the need to figure out how are we going to feed the people of this country, and how are we going to keep people from being killed, and how are we going to prevent those who want to destroy us from destroying us. And in that extreme context, there was a dictatorship that was established by the Bolsheviks. The Bolsheviks had taken on the name Communist Party. There was a one-party dictatorship that was established. It was supposed to be temporary. Unfortunately, it was not temporary, and that was that plus the economic backwardness of the country helped to create an outcome that was qualitatively different from what the original revolutionaries had envisioned. So these are parts of the answer. Also, when you take a look at any civil war, the American Civil War for that matter, or other civil war type activity situations, they can be extremely brutal and brutalizing. And you had that impacting on the people of Russia and on the people who were trying to hold Russia together, the communist regime. All these various things converged to create a very different reality than had been hoped for. But Heidi, there's another piece that needs to be put in here, and that is Lenin, Trotsky, the revolutionaries in Russia did not believe that the kind of socialism they wanted, the kind of free society, the society of the free and the equal, as they said, they didn't feel that that could be established in one backward country, in a world that's dominated by a capitalist economy. They were hopeful, and they believed that workers' movements would generate revolutions in other countries, in more industrially advanced countries. In Germany, there was a real possibility of revolution. It might spread to France. It could spread to other parts of Europe. In Italy, there were tremendous revolutionary currents. So they believed that the Russian Revolution would be joined by other working-class revolutions, including in more economically advanced countries, and that together they would be able to develop a socialist world economy. When they found that those revolutions had been defeated and that they were isolated, that created an even more extreme situation, and the dictatorship that was supposed to be temporary crystallized, became permanent. And then what is a revolutionary supposed to do in that kind of situation? And sometimes power can corrupt. Some of the revolutionaries became corrupt. Others were opposed to that corruption, were opposed to special privileges for people in the top echelons of the party and government. They fought to maintain the original ideals of the revolution. And those people lost, and that's part of the tragedy also, that it became, in spite of its proclaimed revolutionary goals, egalitarian goals, democratic and humanistic goals, it became something other than that. It became the kind of dictatorship that ultimately couldn't be sustained, and you had some years later the collapse of that system.
I agree. I think that the Bolshevik Party took a colossal gamble in taking state power, but they also argued that if they didn't, they would be crushed, and the kind of society that would have been set up by really fascist elements in Russia wouldn't have been pretty either. But, Paul, we're coming down to the end of our allotted time, and I wanted to get to the part about the lessons we might learn from the revolution. The Russian revolutionaries had the pithy slogan, bread, peace, and land. What demands do you think American socialists should put forward today, albeit we're hardly in a pre-revolutionary situation?
Right. I think, Michael, that what you said before is also extremely important. That is, the Bolsheviks realized that if the working class and the laboring masses didn't move forward to take power, that power would be taken by terrible, violent, exploitative forces, similar to what took power in Germany under Hitler and Mussolini's Italy. So that's one important lesson. That is, if we want to solve our problems in a democratic way and in a humanistic way, we need to struggle for power to the majority of the people and not settle for, politicians claiming that they're going to take care of us and assuming that they're going to take care of us. We have to establish genuine democratic control of our government, of our politics, of our economy, by the majority of the people, working class people, blue collar, white collar, and so on. I think that's one lesson that the Bolsheviks helped to put forward that continues to be relevant. We have to recognize that we live in a different situation, so we can't say peace bred land to solve American problems, but we have to look at the actual situation of the people here, and I can't blueprint that has to emerge from the actual lived experience of people. But I would guess that a living wage, decent health care for all, an environment in which we can live in, as opposed to what's being done with climate change today, it's terrible. And that has to be addressed. So there are issues like that. I think that issues of women's rights, racism, and so forth also have to be addressed. And out of the various struggles around such things, there will be the kinds of pithy slogans that the Bolsheviks came up with, but slogans that are relevant to our own situation and that will lead in a direction of rule by the people over not only our political life but our economic life.
One final question on a personal note, if you don't mind. You were radicalized in the 1960s. In fact, you were in SDS, initially anyway. What was it about the Russian Revolution that attracted you? Why do you consider yourself a socialist?
Well, the Russian Revolution, what it reached for was rule by the people, democracy, politically and economically. I was in Students for a Democratic Society because I believed in that. And so here was an example of large numbers of people in a major country, Russia, that had reached for that and at least initially had grasped that. And it seemed to me that made sense, to learn from that experience. And the idea of control over our economy, democratic control over our economy, ruled by the people over the economy, that's socialism. That's a worthy goal. If we have an economic dictatorship, that can contribute to the lack of genuine political democracy and to all kinds of problems. So these are reasons why I became a socialist and then interested in studying the example of the Russian Revolution to try to learn, what I could from that historical experience and see if some of it might apply to, our current experience.
Paul LeBlanc, the author of the just-published book, October Song, brought out by the wonderful publishing house, Haymarket Books. Paul, thank you so much for all your good scholarly work and your good activism. And Heidi and I are grateful for your being a guest on Law and Disorder.
Well, thank you very much to both of you. I've enjoyed talking with you.
Bye-bye, Paul. Thanks.
Take it easy.
Yeah. Okay. Bye-bye.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.
As soon as you're born, they make you feel small. Instead of it all, but we cannot function, we can feel nothing at all. They hurt us at home, they beat us at school. Yeah.
when we're clever, despise us when we're fools. Then they got us so crazy, we cannot follow their rules. Scared us 20 yards.